And welcome to another edition of the Fresh Ubuntu Podcast. This week we have with us today, first of all, my name is Harlan, and I'm the host of the Fresh Ubuntu Podcast. I'm here with Peter Nicolaitis. He's my co-host this week. We have two special guests today, Alan Pope and Davey Walker, both of the Ubuntu UK podcast, and they're here to join us today and talk about the Ubuntu Development Summit. But first of all, let's get the banter out of the way. How you doing, Peter?
I am doing fantastic, and I'm doing even better because our pals from across the pond are with us today, so it's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, it'll be a lot of fun. By the way, I went and saw Iron Man the other...
Oh, it's about time.
And yeah, I know. It's like I'm a week behind every other geek in the world, but finally went out to see it, and it was a fantastic movie, by the way. So a couple of nice little innuendos there, and all around a real good time, and had a lot of fun with it. So
yeah,
now I can get all the Iron Man jokes. So. Anyway, we're here with Alan Pope. He's been a guest here before on our show. Alan, how are you doing? You just got room service, so why don't you tell us about that?
Well, I really appreciate the long introduction there, because that gave me a chance to eat some of these gorgeous French fries and chomp on this fantastic club sandwich that I'm eating here in the hotel in Prague.
Excellent. Prague is, of course, in Czechoslovakia. That's still a country, isn't it?
It's actually no.
They actually had a thing called civil war.
What was that?
They actually had a thing called a civil war.
Ah, yes, you're right.
He split the country into two.
Uh-huh. Okay, so we are all clear now. You are in Prague. Davey, what are you eating?
I'm actually eating chips and a club sandwich also.
Oh, okay.
That's French fries for everybody over here. When he says chips, he means French fries.
Yeah. Sorry. Yes, in English, we say chips, and in that crazy land over there, they.
Yeah. Although we are an international podcast, most of our listeners do, in fact, speak American. So yeah.
So there you have it.
I'm sorry. You really have to stop making Dave laugh, because he's in danger of spitting his club sandwich all over me.
And by the way, how is the beer over there? I know that you arrived in a little bit later, or later in the evening your time, so you decided to head over to the pub.
Well, when we arrived, we got a taxi from the airport to the hotel, and the taxi driver basically wouldn't let us out until we told him how much of the local currency we were going to tip him. And this was a somewhat embarrassing situation, especially after he nearly killed us on the way from the airport to the hotel. So we got a taste for the local area. He also pointed out the local beers, Pilsner Urquell, which I know is a local beer and apparently, according to our taxi driver, is the best beer in the world. And I didn't really want to argue with him, since he had our life in his hands at the time.
Right.
But yes, we've made it to the bar. Yes.
Excellent. How do Czech cab drivers compare to like those in London or over here in the States? Any thoughts on that?
I think they're all pretty much cut from the same.
Well, I mean, I actually felt like the Czech taxi driver was ruddy awful. I mean, I've never heard so many beeps, so many times driving on the wrong side of the road, so many times leaning over so he can write on his notebook.
Oh yeah, that was good. He took a phone call on his mobile phone, on his cell phone, and he had one hand holding his cell phone and the other hand holding a pen, writing on a pad that was on the passenger seat. Then at this point he went around a corner and someone started blaring their horn at him, and we just looked at each other and laughed and thought, if this is our last moment together, then it was a mildly amusing one at least.
Well, at least you got some laughs out of it there. Yeah. Go with a smile.
So you're there in Prague for the Ubuntu Development Summit. Now, I know the last one was over here in Boston. Are they moving these things around? Apparently.
Yeah. Yeah, they have them all over the place to try and make sure that everyone gets a chance to go. I think they've had one in Australia. There's been one at Mountain View in California. There's been one in Spain, and then back in Boston, and now here in Prague.
Well, one of the first ones was actually in England, I believe, wasn't
it? Yeah, the first one was in London.
Yeah. First one, I think, was in London. Yeah. And the idea behind it is it's a chance for the developers to get together and build up the specifications for what's going in the next release of Ubuntu. But actually, that doesn't start until Monday. What's happening before that is something called FOSCamp. And FOSCamp, which you can get more details at foscamp.org, is what's commonly called an unconference. It's a conference for anyone, not just Ubuntu, but any open source free software person to come along and talk about their products, their services, what they do, and really, you know, have a discussion with other people. And in past FOSCamps, we've talked with people from Red Hat, talked with people from IBM, Intel, Sun, you know, all these people who are not really anything directly to do with Ubuntu, to kind of bring everyone together. And it's a really cool event. It really works well.
Cool.
Sorry, I'll stop talking now.
Oh, there you go.
It's okay. Harlem will wake up again in a moment.
So I've never been to one, and it sounds like some exciting stuff going on there. I know, Peter, you almost had a chance because it was so close to you. But
I definitely had a chance. I just didn't – back last year, I just didn't I didn't think that going to the developer summit was real. I'm not an Ubuntu developer, you know, so I just said, I don't know. But now that I've got more friends. Yeah, well, exactly. And now that I've got more friends in the Ubuntu community and I know a little more about it, I probably will go the next time that there's one in my region.
That's exciting.
Rumor has it. There's a rumor, nothing more than a rumor, you understand, that the next one might be in your region.
Is that back in Boston or New York, or where are they talking?
Well, you're half of the planet. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Right. Well, okay. Yeah. My region I define that as an area called New England. It's named after a country I think you're familiar with.
Your house and the end of your road. Is that as far
exactly
as you go?
Northern New England, specifically in the state of Vermont, within about 30 miles of my house, which is the odds of that ever coming this way are slim to never. So
I believe it's going to be in the continent of America. Does that help narrow it down at all?
That helps a lot. That helps a lot. And because that way I know that everyone here will speak American also, so I'll be able to understand them.
We didn't say North or South America.
Yeah, I understood that. I caught that, actually. But, you know, the Brazilians, they're nice people too.
Before I actually go to America, I do actually need to get an American phrase book because I just don't understand the language.
Like French fries. Oh boy! What do you?
I must apologize for my colleague here.
You know, you don't have to, but I don't know. Maybe we should. Otherwise,
I'll never get invited on this podcast ever again. Thanks for today.
Oh goodness! On that note, what do you think, Harlem? Should we do the news?
Yeah. Let's go ahead and do the news. Any other thoughts on the Ubuntu Developers Summit, fellas?
Well. There's nothing started yet. I mean, we'll, by all means, feel free to check in with us later in the week and we'll give you an update. Okay, or, of course, people could listen to our podcast, which they can find at podcast.ubuntu-uk.org.
Fantastic.
Yeah, beep that out, will you, Harlem?
We'll have to edit that.
I was
going to
say, the alternative URL is shamelessplug.com.
Isn't that shamelessplug.co.uk?
Of course.
All right. Well, thanks again for joining us. You're going to stick around for the news, and we appreciate that. And so we're going to pause for just a second for this short musical break. So be right back.
See, I didn't lie. He does do that.
Yes, but what you guys don't know is this part will not be edited out. Just mark my words. Everyone will hear this again.
I have to apologize, Harlem. You are going to have such a nightmare editing this.
Judging from the last podcast, I didn't edit a thing, so this might make it on there. So, and that's okay because we're all human. So, we are back from our short little break for the news segment, and this week we have a ton of news. Some related to Ubuntu, some barely stretching the 6 degrees of John O. Bacon. So we are just going to go ahead and dive right into it. The first one here is yours, Peter.
Okay. I guess I'm on the spot then, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we wanted to open on a serious note. There is a serious OpenSSL, OpenSSH vulnerability, which traces its roots back to Debian and therefore all Debian-based distros, which of course includes Ubuntu. Basically, the problem, excuse me, is it's a vulnerability.
That's going to make it on the podcast.
Yeah, I'm sure. Wow, I don't know what just happened. Swallowed something. Anyway, the long and short of it is that you want to be upgrading your OpenSSH and OpenSSL packages as soon as possible if you haven't already. This vulnerability was discovered on the 13th of May, which is a couple of days before we're recording this right now, so it's quite likely that people still haven't upgraded or haven't heard about it even yet. Essentially, your passwords and your keys can be cracked, so because they're... excuse me. I'm having trouble getting a full sentence out. So what I'm going to stop it at is... do an apt-get update, apt-get upgrade as quickly as possible, and make sure your OpenSSL and OpenSSH are at the latest version. And I'm going to leave it at that.
Yep. And by the way, there is if you haven't done an upgrade update yet, you can check out ubuntu-tutorials.com. They have a confirm that you have the vulnerability and fix instructions for it. But the easiest way to do it is do a sudo dash update and then a upgrade after that, and that should fix it. And then if you want to, you can run the test to see if you still have the vulnerability. And I'll have the links in the show notes. But fellas, can you shine some light on why, how, and how this made it into the release?
I'm no expert on this, but as I understand it, there was code introduced in Debian which caused the random number generator that's used when generating keys to produce predictable outputs. So a random number generator should produce random numbers.
Absolutely.
But due to the bug that was introduced, the random numbers are not random, as it were. And the result of that is that it's possible to compromise someone's keys that they use for things like SSH, SSL, and I think other things maybe... compromised by this.
But I think when you say compromise, it's not literally just actually be able to compromise. It's a case of brute force attack. Mm-hmm. So basically, if you treat it the same as a plain text password, or sorry, not plain text, but a password, then it's the same as be able to brute force a password. So it's not actually as major, in my opinion, as people are making out.
Right. But the one key thing to note is that if you... and this is something your average user won't do. But if you happen to have got more than one machine and rather than use passwords, you've used keys to log on from one machine to another using SSH, then it's possible that those keys should be replaced. And I think one of the tools that's referred to on the website you mentioned, which is, I think it's Chester's blog, Ubuntu Tutorials, the tool determines whether you've got insecure keys and whether they should be replaced. And there are how-tos around this linked from the security notice that came out from Ubuntu.
Right.
In a nutshell, yes, upgrading the packages fixes the random number generator, but it doesn't fix having broken keys already.
I'm back. I want to chime in on that. Actually, the upgrade does launch a a reconfigure, and it will actually identify. It did on my systems. It pointed out when I did have vulnerable keys, and it regenerated them.
Did it actually generate keys for your local user or just the host key?
I think it only generates the host key.
Yes, I think it was just the host key.
Because the you need to regenerate the host key, which is great that Ubuntu in their package have regenerated the host key as part of that update. But the thing that most users use is actually the user key, and that's the one
you're right.
Yep. Will be caught by. And so that needs regenerating, and there are various how-tos linked all over the place. It's going to be big news all over the place, so there's plenty of tutorial.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think the big danger attached to the host key and why that had to be changed is because I think that does open up the distributions to man-in-the-middle attacks, where someone can sit in the middle and actually pass through traffic to where it's intended and actually sit in the middle and actually capture data. Because if you actually get someone's private host key, then they can actually pretend to be the server which you think you're logging into.
Interesting.
Classic man-in-the-middle attack. So.
Yep.
It was quite timely for me because I've just rolled out a bunch of new servers here, a bunch of new virtual machines at the office, so I had to be generating new keys for them anyway. So I don't have to do it twice. It's great. I had to do it anyway.
Did you actually think to yourself, is it worth me actually writing a script to actually automate many servers to upgrade all at once, or should I do it manually? Because I can decide.
I wouldn't call it many. I've got about half a dozen. It's not all that bad. I mean, it really is just a matter of copying and pasting a few lines of codes in this case for me.
Cool.
All right. Well, let's move along. We've got some more stuff to cover. And basically, for those of you who are on the fence still about upgrading to Hardy Heron, you might want to check out Ars Technica's review of the operating system. The Heron has landed, a review of Ubuntu 8.04. Pretty much a straightforward review here, and quite positive. Highlights some of the things that are new to Hardy Heron, for instance, the Wubi installer, and a lot of other things. Go ahead and check that out at arstechnica.com/reviews/os/hardy-heron-reviews.ars, and all these links will be on freshubuntu.org in the show notes. Anything to add about that? Are you running Heron now, Peter?
Yes, on my notebook, and I've upgraded my virtual machines on my desktop, and I have upgraded my desktop, my main desktop, but unfortunately work has had me just running Windows for like the last 2 weeks almost exclusively, so I haven't gone back to finish tweaking that. There were a bunch of little things that I had to get working on it, and I haven't had the time to. Unfortunately, when for doing that, making my Linux desktop work the way I want to falls under like fun category, and I haven't had a lot of time for fun in the last couple of weeks.
Sorry to hear that.
Yeah, well, you know, it means that I'm paying the bills though, so I'm okay with that. So, should we move on?
Yep.
All right. Other things in release in distro news: Linux Mint 5 beta is out, and the code name for this release is Elissa. And again, this one is built on Hardy Heron, so they're keeping along. And Harlem and I were having a little chat about this before the show. And one of the things, there were two concerns that I raised about Mint when we were talking about it earlier in the year. One of them was the fact that it is not a rolling distro, so there's no simple upgrade path. And but then we decided, you know, with all the issues that are still around with an Ubuntu upgrade, that you know, heck, for me, Ubuntu isn't really a rolling upgrade either. I had really good luck on most of my desktops when I did rolling upgrades, but on my server, basically the thing wouldn't even boot with the newest kernel. And I had to go and reconfigure our whole RAID arrays, and I ended up just scrapping the whole thing and migrating to a new install. But back to Mint, the new version has multiple improvements in the Mint menu and the Mint update packages, And they've also, excuse me, added some new features to the wallpaper desktop environment. A lot of just, you know, standard usability enhancements. And they're boasting, quote, a better look and feel. So, you know, one of the things they've made is a different, like a color palette widget thing. So you can make it even greener, which I thought is great because, you know, we want our distros to be green, right?
Right.
go brown. Go brown.
What can brown do for you?
The problem I had with Linux Mint, and I'm not a complete expert, but I heard an interview with one of the Linux Mint guys, and I understand that they recommend you don't apply packages that come from Ubuntu until they've checked them first, mm-hmm. which makes me somewhat twitchy about do they have the capacity to check all updates that come from Ubuntu to make sure that they don't conflict with anything in Mint.
Right.
Can I ask, how is that different to Ubuntu Check and Debian packages?
Because Ubuntu Canonical pay people to check packages that are in main, and it's their job to do it, whereas Linux Mint is one guy, apparently, who checks
exactly.
the stuff before it goes into Mint.
I can't comment.
It's another level. So Ubuntu create patches for this SSL problem that there has been recently. You know, what if you had to wait for this guy to check these packages to make sure it wouldn't break anything in Mint? How much longer would a Mint user be vulnerable to issues than an Ubuntu user?
I certainly got the impression there was more than one user to.
Sorry.
Oh my god. I certainly got the impression there was more than one developer attached to Linux Mint. So I'd be quite surprised if there wasn't more than one.
There is one main developer, as I understand it, and that he is pretty much the core development team, as I understand it from the last interviews that I've heard and from articles that I've read.
So that would be a little scary for me. So do you compromise system security for greenness?
Well, that was the thing, too. Right. The other big concern that I had actually was security, and you know, was like security updates. What if, you know, what if that one developer's on vacation for a couple of weeks and, say, you know, a big OpenSSL vulnerability appears or something and, you know, you can't get your package updates for a while. Mm. So
see,
I saw that
one problem I actually have, I don't, people who know me know I don't particularly like KDE. And also, I don't particularly like Brown. So I'm actually trying to decide which I actually dislike more so I can go with. So Linux Mint might actually be the option.
You know, Dave, there's this option in the menu to change the look of the desktop. You can download things and everything.
Is there?
Yeah.
You can change colors too. Yeah, really easily. Yep.
I'll still have to.
A screencast. When did we last see a screencast?
Yeah, that's me. Carry on.
Carry on.
All right. So while we're speaking of distro releases, I hear that other Linux thing, the hat release there came out with a new version or something this week.
The hat, the Fedora.
The hat.
Are you talking
the Fedora? Yeah, that's the one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Version 9.
Fedora 9. Yeah, you're right. It came out. I haven't downloaded it. I don't plan on downloading it or installing it. I might, but just too much on my plate. Do you guys play around with other distros? I have limited time, and basically I don't play around with other distros.
I keep an eye on them, and I'm a member of a Linux user group, which obviously means there are people there who run different distros that are not Ubuntu, strangely enough. So, you know, I get to see what's new and I read the release announcements, and I notice that there are some funky things in Fedora 9. As I remember it, there's they're going with a fairly new version of Network Manager. I think, haven't they got Network Manager 0.7 or something, which is apparently much better than some of the previous releases. And they've also gone, I believe, with PackageKit, the new kind of abstraction layer for package management in Linux, which was started by Richard Hughes, the guy who did GNOME Power Manager. So yeah, they've got some new cool stuff in there, and stuff that I know will ripple down to Ubuntu at some point. But that's one of the problems with staggered releases, and I know you'll talk about releases later.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. If I end up getting sick or suffer a blow to the head or something, I probably will download and install Fedora, because that's generally what it takes for me. I get sick or I'm on weird cold medicine and stuff, and then I do weird things like install RPM-based distros, which I swore that I would never, ever do again.
Yep. You did install the last Fedora release, didn't you?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. So, yep. And
at that time, I remember you were... You were on.
Sorry, Dave.
Go ahead.
Sorry, Dave's in the middle of eating tonight. I just saw, as you said, you were going to put Fedora on if you had a bonk on the head. Dave put his thumb in the air, and I didn't know if that meant that's good that you would put Fedora on a machine, or that's good you need a bonk on the head. Or
I think maybe he's offering to hit me on the head or something.
Well, hey, if you want to catch a plane out here to the UDS summit, I'll gladly oblige. But no, what I was actually inferring was I'm not a fan of RPM-based distributions. I don't like RPM packaging.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. Hey, I used to love it. When I first found RPMs, they were great. And then I experienced RPM hell, and, you know, this dependency required that dependency, which required this dependency. And, you know, after I realized that I was spending more time trying to resolve RPM dependencies than I would compiling from source, I gave up on that. And then I just, you know, I found Debian and apt, and it just seems to handle dependencies and things like that so much more cleanly that I don't want to go back.
So you don't actually have to Google for your dependencies anymore, and each dependency which cascades down and down and down, you just don't have to do that anymore. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. Isn't that nice?
It's probably a good job we don't have many Fedora listeners.
Yeah, well, this is not the Fresh Fedora podcast, but you know, if someone wants me to be a co-host on that, I can be sideman for that too. That might be fun. Just kidding.
For a given definition of fun. Yes.
Right. All right. Let's move on. Not a distro release per se, but software wise, Wine version 1.0 release candidate 1 is out. So Wine, Windows, you know, Wine's not an emulator. The Windows application compatibility layer version 1 is just around the corner. So if you want to check that out, go right ahead. Now, the Ubuntu doesn't package the latest versions of Wine all the time, right, guys? Because I always find a newer version when I go over to winehq.org.
Isn't that the same for every package, really?
Yeah, but I mean, Wine is one of those packages that gets updated like all the time. I think they release a new version like every 2 weeks or something.
Yeah, and I think it's only fair that you should in your distro of choice, you should put a fairly well-tested application.
Yeah, absolutely.
In regards to Wine, I mean, I would have actually been interested in what you two actually use Wine for, because I know I probably use Wine probably once a release cycle. So what do you actually use Wine for that you can't find natively in the repositories?
Well, the one thing that I've been trying to get Wine to do for me is play World of Warcraft, and I'm still not successful on that. So, but
you do know that I wouldn't be surprised if your podcasts actually come out less frequently when you get into Warcraft, because I understand it takes over people's lives. People lose their wives, their jobs.
I'm quite aware of that. No,
yeah, so it's
probably
a good thing that it doesn't work, really.
Exactly. But it's also one of the things, it keeps me from booting into Ubuntu more often, though. So if I can get that to boot, you know, to work natively, then I can stop running Windows a lot more, too. So, you know, it's a catch-22.
Well, I honestly don't use Wine for anything. However, I did in the last podcast mention that, I dual boot. And since Ubuntu comes by default with NTFS read and write capability, I tried opening an application on my Vista partition, and lo and behold, it did actually run through the Wine application layer, or whatever it's called, and got that to work. So that was kind of neat. But other than that, I don't use Wine for anything other than, you know, I put it on every time I upgrade my distro. So,
The only thing I've really used it for recently is my I have a TiVo-like device.
Best read and write capability. I tried opening an application on my Vista partition, and lo and behold, it did actually run through the Wine application layer, whatever it's called, and got that to work. So that was kind of neat. But other than that, I don't use Wine for anything other than, you know, I put it on every time I upgrade my distro. So
the only thing I've really used it for recently is my I have a TiVo-like device, and the people who make it put their firmware on their website, and they only make a Windows application for updating it. And so you need a serial cable, and I've got an old laptop. It's the only machine I've got that's got a serial port, and Wine just about runs this BIOS update thing. And so long as you don't breathe near it or touch anything at all while it's updating, then it will update my like TiVo-like device. And that's the only reason I use Wine, really.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many other options now. I mean, the state of open source software is really growing by leaps and bounds. And on top of that, there's a lot of things that you can do in the cloud, doing cloud computing too. So, you know, an emulation layer or what have you, almost not needed at this point, unless you are like Peter, running
playing
games
World
on
of
it.
Warcraft. Mm-hmm. Yep.
And there's actually a paid for version that you can
of Wine. Before Wine changed the license, yes,
it was previously BSD license, wasn't it?
Yeah, they took I can't remember that, but I don't know what license it was. But Sedega took before they were called Sedega, they were Transgaming, weren't they? Mm. And they took Wine, an older version of Wine, and basically added support for things like drive protection and other various things, and basically never fed that back to the Wine project. So some people in the Wine project view, and some users view Sedega with some derision because they haven't given back, which they didn't need to because the license didn't say they had to. But, you know, it's kind of one of those moral things.
Yep. Well, we're going to talk about that momentarily. Actually, while you're mentioning that, why don't we skip ahead really quickly? Speaking of open source licensing and giving back to the community, Alan, last time you were on our podcast, we actually spoke a little bit about Sun and VirtualBox and MySQL and how we're fearing that their stuff might become more proprietary now that Sun was owning both of those companies, Innotek and MySQL. And on that note, last week, Kai Arnaud posted on his blog about how MySQL Server is and will always remain fully functional and open source. And I thought this was pretty timely because go ahead.
Sorry, go on.
Okay, well, anyway, we had spoken about that, about how they had the you know, the whole dual licensing thing. And, you know, Kai points out that, you know, they had a dual licensing model, you know, previous to the purchase, to the Sun buyout. And I thought it was interesting because also I found another article which talks about basically the moral of the story is read the fine print, because a lot of companies are now apparently starting to use open source as a catchphrase. And basically open source does not necessarily mean GPL. And it doesn't necessarily mean that it's all, you know, completely open for you to do anything you want with. And you know, and I guess MySQL would be one of those examples possibly. But, you know, it is fully functional and is open source, but they're going to be offering separate proprietary stuff with it. As opposed to, for instance, you know, I don't know how. What do you think? How do you think that compares, for instance, to Transgaming taking Wine and just doing what they want with it without contributing back to the community? What's your feeling on something like that?
Well, I must say, my feeling is they're completely separate. I mean, MySQL has got its reputation from being free and open source software, and it's been one of the big successes of free software. To suddenly change the license so the non-free version doesn't include the latest and greatest features, being fully functional, is that actually enough? I mean, why? I mean, there are alternatives out there, and some would say even more efficient, such as PostgreSQL. Why stick with MySQL if they're not giving the latest and greatest features in the free version?
Interesting. It's tricky. I can see reasoning for having two separate versions, and there's for example, VirtualBox, that's also owned by Sun, has two separate versions. There's the private and end user license version, and then there's the open source version, and there are differences in those two products, and that happened before Sun acquired Innotek. And also there's differences between Java. The open version of Java has different code than the enterprise version of Java that Sun sell to their enterprise customers. The APIs are implemented much the same, so the code should run on both, but underneath it there's proprietary code in the enterprise version of Java that's not in the open version of Java.
But did Innotek and Java, did they get their reputation from being free open source software to start with, where they had their pricing model and such laid down to start? I mean,
Java certainly didn't. I mean, Java was free, as in, you know, you can buy it, you know, you can download the player and program it for free, but it certainly wasn't open source from the get-go.
Yeah, but I mean, MySQL has got its feet into so many doors and so many companies now, to suddenly turn around and say, hey, you're not going to get the latest and greatest anymore, to me that seems a bit unfair. I mean, I'm guessing that it's previously been worth having, and the reason Sun actually purchased it. I mean, they claim that this idea was already in the pipeline before the actual buyout. Why didn't we hear about it before then? It just seems rather strange. It suddenly comes out very quickly after Sun purchased them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It seems to me that, reading the fine print article, it kind of hits it on the nose, that they're using the term open source as the way a lot of food companies can use the term organic. And it's sort of a catchphrase kind of thing, just to lead, you know, as a marketing technique. Is that what this is?
There's always been the conflict between those who use the term, you know, open source, and those who use the term free. And of course, someone like Richard Stallman absolutely doesn't like the use of the term open source. He would rather all software was free and not, you know, not open source, because free gives you the right to do things with the software that open source doesn't. So, you know, you can see why there's a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And that article that I referenced, that we will include a link to, actually talks about that, about how when he started, when he started the marketing bandwagon talking about free software, that the perception was, you know, free as in you should not have to pay for it. And, you know, hey, I was guilty of that. I thought that's what it was all about, free software, because for a long time, all of this, you know, free and open source software was free, as in beer. I could just download it. And when I first started to find, you know, free, quote unquote, software that you had to pay for, like, you know, you had to buy Red Hat. You didn't have to, but you could. I was like, well, wait a minute, how are they selling it? You know, and that's still, I think, a common question when people hear about open source software and free software today is, you know, how do they make money? Why do I have to pay for it if it's quote unquote free, etc.? So that article that we'll include a link to actually talks about that, and how now, you know, the term open source is becoming more popular, but it's also, you know, there are varying degrees of open when you're talking about open source. So, you know, the idea, that's what the title is, read the fine print, because make sure you know what kind of open source you're getting.
I see. Got it. Speaking of proprietary and open source, we got something from the Free Software Foundation about getting GNUSense, or as you put it, Peter, nuisance.
I called that one I stole from one of our friendly UK podcasts. Nuisance, yes, exactly. Well, this goes to answer the question, what would Stallman run, right?
Mm-hmm.
What would Richard Stallman do?
Yep.
Well, in the past, he said that he runs, there's a very small distro called Utotu, which I was at FOSDEM, which is a conference that happens at Brussels a couple of years ago, and someone asked him, what distro do you use? And he said he uses something called Utotu, which is a totally free distribution. But in the meantime, I've seen him say that he doesn't actually use computers that often, and in fact, in order to get access to web pages, he emails a bot with the URL of a page that he wants, and the bot emails him back the web page. So you know, how in touch Richard Stallman is with, you know, the real world right now as right. to what distros yes. people use, I'm not entirely convinced.
Well, that goes. One of my old college professors, one of my favorite teachers of all time, said, I had dinner with him last year sometime, and he said, the world needs a Richard Stallman, but it probably doesn't need more than one.
Yeah, totally. And if it wasn't for people like Richard Stallman, you know, a lot of us wouldn't be where we are today with the software that we have and the, you know, you can go out and buy, as I'm sure you're going to talk about shortly, machines with Linux embedded in them, Linux on them. Yeah, I'm talking to you through my EPC running Linux. Okay, I'm using Skype, but it's running, you know, majority of the software on it is free software. And that just wouldn't get where it was if it wasn't for someone like Richard Stallman.
Yeah.
So we have a lot to be thankful for, really.
Absolutely.
Yep. Well, mm-hmm. I couldn't have let in better, but it just happens that Los Alamos Computers is now offering pre-installed machines with GNU Sense on them. And we actually...
Stallman, you know, a lot of us wouldn't be where we are today with the software that we have and the, you know, you can go out and buy, as I'm sure you're going to talk about shortly, machines with Linux embedded in them, Linux on them. Yeah, I'm talking to you through my EPC. Running Linux, okay, I'm using Skype, but it's running, you know, majority of the software on it is free software. And that just wouldn't get where it was if it wasn't for someone like Richard Stallman.
Yeah.
Yep.
So we have a lot to be thankful for, really.
Absolutely. Yep.
Well, mm-hmm. I couldn't have let in better, but it just happens that Los Alamos Computers is now offering pre-installed machines with GNU Sense on them. And we actually pulled this right off of the FSF blog. So if you want to, you know, be really completely free open source, you can do so. Basically, go on over to Los Alamos and buy your Microsoft free, proprietary free, closed source free systems.
And let's talk about the word free here for a second. It's, mm-hmm. it's not just the free as in beer, as lots of Linux circles like to put it. It's the free as in liberated. Unencumbered, or maybe even DRM-free kind of sense of the word. So yes, it is free. You don't have to pay much for it, but it's also free in the sense that you can do whatever you want with it. You can redistribute it, put it on two or three machines if you want from the same source package and that kind of thing. So just wanted to make sure.
Use Weatherbug. My only encounters with Weatherbug were a few years ago when it was widely accepted as spyware. And even though they claim that it's not, it is at the very least adware because you do get pop-ups and stuff. So I thought that this was a wonderful step forward, that now we can have yet another thing on Linux that we don't generally get a lot of, but our Windows users have. So we no longer have to be envious. We even have a quick and simple, easy way to download our spyware. And I thought that's just great.
I like CNR. And if you've ever been on their site, and the reason why I like CNR is because they have this package ranking feature. If you go on their site, what's the number one package being downloaded? You know, you sort of have the social aspect of packages. You know, what's everybody else downloading? What is perhaps you wanted to look for finance management packages? Which finance management package is the most popular, or which one is the most used? So I sort of like that aspect of CNR. True, there is a business side to it, and, you know, I'm sure... I haven't found it yet, but I'm sure that there is software that is worth paying for. And again, I haven't found it yet, so it remains to be seen.
My gut reaction when you said Linspire, Click and Run, Linux Mint, I just thought, who and who?
One Ubuntu derivative is now compatible. One Ubuntu derivative's package manager is now compatible with another Ubuntu derivative, and you can use it to get spyware. Does that help?
Yes,
that's great. Okay. Thanks for the summary.
Thank you. You're welcome. Moving swiftly on, you mentioned something weird about getting Linux on laptop. Linux on motherboards. And Splashtop. That's right. Splashtop Linux apparently is going to be included. Now, they say on every Asus motherboard. So I'm kind of curious now. Apparently this splash top thing is an instant on Linux desktop that has been available in some high-end Asus motherboards like the P5Q. But apparently they say it's going to be in every motherboard. Now, Alan, are you familiar with this project?
Yeah, it's funny, actually, because this rings bells in my mind to a conversation I had with one of the Canonical marketing guys a year ago, actually, at UDS in Spain. And he was telling me that one of the big developments in laptop technology and one of the great things for Linux is that the laptop vendors and the motherboard vendors are striving to get Linux support for all the hardware devices in their machines. And the reason for this is that some of these machines are going to be made with a system where you can press a button and turn the machine on, and it comes on near instantly for you to be able to play DVDs and get on the web and get access to the internet, like, instantly.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, I heard, like, it was the functions like the DVD player, for instance.
It has lots of other software built in, like Skype. Sorry.
Right, I'm sorry, I you cut out for a bit. Sorry, I guess I talked over you. I thought you were done speaking. So I'll shut up. Go ahead.
Sorry. Yeah, this system has embedded Linux that has Skype, a web browser, and all kinds of other basic functional apps that you'd need, but in a near instant on, under 10 seconds to turn on. Okay, it's not instant, but it's pretty damn close.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yuppers. So that'll be kind of cool. Now here's a question though. But they say that this is going to be in all Asus motherboards. Does that mean that Splashtop is going to be available for the EPC?
That's a good question. You know, what happens to the Zandros install that you get on your EPC on the flash drive? Do they supply a machine that has Splashtop and Windows XP, and then Zandros goes out the window? I don't know.
Yeah,
I haven't actually tried Splashtop myself. But from looking at the screenshots and the presentation video, which is on their webpage, it actually looks, in my opinion, very similar to the Zandros desktop. So it wouldn't surprise me if future ultra-portable laptops drop away from Zandros and move on to Splashtop.
Yeah. Now, when you say it looks similar, you mean like in the novice mode there, not the full KDE version?
I mean the girly mode that Alan uses.
Right, exactly. Thank you. Yeah.
Thanks for that.
Harlan, what's next?
I have to just clarify here. I've got two Asus 701s and two Asus 900s, and all of them use the Zandros girly mode, as Dave calls it. Yeah. And Dave uses Ubuntu on his EPC. Now, I was sat here earlier on, and I managed to get on the wireless, and Dave spent something like half an hour trying to figure out why he couldn't get software updates to his Ubuntu system. Hang on, he's trying to fight me for the microphone now. and it turns out that he was connected to the wrong access point. I mean, clearly there's something wrong with the interface there if you can't. I don't know. What's going wrong there, Dave?
Well, I think that was a case of a PEPCAC issue. I didn't actually sign in through the portal interface. And I think you could arguably mention that the same mistake could happen on any distribution, including Windows.
Yeah, you could make the same mistake because you are the same person, no matter which distribution you were using, Dave. Yes, that's right.
Oh my God. But then again, Windows is always kind of in girly mode, don't you think?
Teletubby mode, we like to call it.
Teletubby mode, even better. Okay, let's move on.
Moving right along.
Before we get too far, I did want to also mention on software releases that OpenOffice 3.0 is now in beta. It has been since last week. OpenOffice, yeah, another one of those things that has indirectly come out of Sun, actually. And version 3.0 is, it's around the corner. They've got some new features. They're including Office 2007 import filters, so you can open those annoying docx files, some improvements in charting, some better notes and annotations in writing, better PDF support, It will run natively as an Aqua app on OS 10. Doesn't require X11 anymore. So we'll put a link in the show notes if you want to see a bunch of the release notes and everything that's coming around the corner with OpenOffice 3.0.
Excellent. Very good. Next on the list is we have something about the OLPC, one laptop per child. And lately they've been going through some weird fluctuations. On May 2nd, this article came out from the Technology Review published by MIT and talks about the new president of the OLPC project. His name is Charles Kane and is a former software executive and a mergers and acquisition specialist. So, not entirely familiar with the one laptop per child, other than the fact that they're going through some, growing pains, as they say, wondering whether Windows will be installed on it or not, and sounds like a ploy from Microsoft, perhaps. Your thoughts, gentlemen?
I'm kind of disappointed at this because the OLPC has been plagued with software issues. You know, it's the interface is not fantastic for, you know, your average person. It's probably great for someone in the middle of nowhere who hasn't had exposure to a Windows desktop. But it looks to me like Microsoft have successfully argued that, you know, XP is the environment, or Windows is the environment that most people will use, and therefore they should ship OLPCs with Windows. And enough time has passed now that they can get the spec of the OLPC up to the point where it can run Windows. Mm-hmm. And Microsoft have had enough time to get XP down to the point where it will run on an OLPC.
Right.
And because of the delays in the project and the amount of time that's passed, it's got to the state where that can happen. And because that can happen, you know, people in those positions of power over the project are going to let it happen, which is very sad.
Right.
Yep.
Now, one of the main features about OLPC is that it was really made for children in the educational environment, and I don't know what the particular vision of the OLPC project was, but it seems to me it's fighting between getting a particular agenda out there, whether it be a particular operating system, or is their main focus educating children regardless of what operating system?
Well, from the talks that I've seen, it was always these people have they have running water, they have electricity to a certain degree, they have buildings, they have food, but what they need is education. And one tool that you know we have in the West that maybe they don't have many of is laptops. And we, you know, sending our old laptops to them is no good because they're not ruggedized. They consume a vast amount of power compared to the OLPC. They don't work in bright sunlight, and they're very expensive to replace parts. So this OLPC was designed to overcome all of these issues, and it's possible to take an OLPC, you know, to the remote parts of wherever, and the battery lasts for ages. It works in bright sunlight. It's fairly ruggedized keyboard, and you know, one of the key things that was mentioned at one of the conferences I went to was what you got to remember is for the OLPC, people who have one, when they take it back to their house, that OLPC may be the only source of light in their house. And if you think of that as the kind of user that might be using an OLPC, you get an appreciation for what level these people are at and what, you know, what help can be provided by an OLPC. And with the interface that was made and the mesh networking and the charging system, the multi-bay charging system, and okay, the hand crank charger went out the window, but you know, there were various options for multi-way charging and stuff. And the lengthy battery life, it seemed like a good project. Right. And I just feel that by putting XP on it and, you know, standard Windows apps instead of the well-developed Sugar interface, I think they're throwing away an opportunity.
Yeah, yeah. My feeling exactly. I just I'm sad to see some of the changes. It had a full head of steam about a year and a half ago, and suddenly you don't hear much about it anymore. And it's quite a shame, so... Let's talk about something a little bit more light. The Art of the Release, Ubuntu, on Mark Shuttleworth's blog, has committed to the next long-term support release of Ubuntu, and it'll be in 2010, April 2010. And part of what his blog is saying is that he'd like other distros to maybe mirror the release schedule of Ubuntu. And a lot of the comments on the blog is that because Mark Shuttleworth also said that he's willing to fudge on the release of Ubuntu in order to get all the distros all on one line. Some of the comments on the blog has been somewhat, I don't know, that they're saying like Fedora's next release is going to be here. Why don't your next long-term support release be at this time? And if you're so willing to change your release cycle, why don't you change it to that cycle? Anybody want to respond to that?
Yeah. I haven't read any. I've read Mark's post, and I haven't read any of the replies to that blog post. But it does seem disingenuous from some of those people commenting in such a way, because the fact is that nobody else, as far as I'm aware, in the other distros has stepped up and said this. Mm. None of the other distros have said, "Hey Ubuntu, hey SUSE, we'll change our long-term support release date in order to closely align with yours." They're not asking to match it exactly, but closely align and get similar package versions across those long-term support releases. And remember, this isn't every release. This is just the long-term support release he's trying to align. And it makes total sense from a developer point of view. You can develop applications and have a known target that's going to be, you know, Ubuntu's long-term support release, Red Hat's long-term support release, or SUSE, or whoever, and you know that you're going to have roughly the same versions of libraries, roughly the same versions of applications, and it makes a developer's life so much easier rather than targeting, you know, 8 different Linux distributions and having to have lots of different packages based on lots of different libraries. It's just a horrid, horrid mess.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so I think it's a great idea, but, you know, clearly I would think it's a great idea. But notice that Mark has actually said we would change our date. So those people who are saying, why don't you follow the date of Fedora? Well, he hasn't said we won't. He said we will change the date of Ubuntu's LTS release.
Yep.
To closely match the others. So I think it's it's somewhat sour grapes from some of the other distros that they don't, you know, maybe they don't have the forward thinking vision that that Mark has to think of this kind of idea.
Yeah, I do agree that it would benefit all users in the end, a predictable release cycle, and I'm hoping that something will come about with this, and really more dialogue needs to come from other distros as well. You know, whether it be Red Hat or SUSE or whoever.
Well. Now combine this with PackageKit, mm-hmm. which Fedora 9, I believe, has PackageKit, and I believe there are talks about having PackageKit in the next version of Ubuntu. Now that means it would probably be very mature by the time the next Ubuntu LTS release comes out.
Right.
If you put PackageKit in all the major distributions or something, some similar technology to abstract the package management, then it again makes it easier for both developers and users to be able to install and manage the applications that they have on their system.
Yeah.
And, you know, combine all these things together. You're not going to end up with one unified Linux distribution. You'll have multiple Linux distributions, each with their own subtle differences, whatever they may be. But in the end, you know, lots of different happy users and much happier developers, in my mind.
Yeah. Peter?
Yeah, we've talked about this before, and I thought that was, when I first heard that, you know, Shuttleworth was saying, hey, everybody, you know, sync your release schedule with us, I said, I don't know. But when I heard that he said, you know, or, you know, we'll change ours and sync with you, I'm like, okay, I like that. And, I don't know. I could see, I guess, some people just might have a philosophical opposition to it, but I don't share that. I think that, if it helps the get everything in line with, like your desktop environments, if GNOME and KDE and those other, environments are following a similar release schedule to that of the distros, or vice versa. I just, it sounds like a good thing. Help everything get a little more predictable.
Yep.
Of course, the other counter side is maybe some people would be scared by this, because if they all did line up, then people would really be able to compare one distro to another. In the right now, what happens is, if you compared Fedora 9 with Ubuntu Hardy right now, you would see that Fedora 9 has newer packages than Ubuntu Hardy. Mm-hmm. But then wait for the next release of Ubuntu, and Ubuntu has better packaging and newer features and better bug fixes. So maybe these people are scared that actually, when you do the comparison between three systems running different Linux distros that are at the same release point, that maybe theirs won't shine as much as they thought it did.
Yeah, you bring up a good point. That could be the case, too, that this one-upsmanship will not be able to happen if there weren't this staggered release. And, you do bring up a good point, and they may be scared. So,
Now, I don't actually use Fedora. I think I administer one box, which is RPM-based. Now, to me, it's not a big issue. I don't really care what's running in Fedora. It doesn't make any difference to me. Now, we've got the release schedule for going up to 2011 for Ubuntu. Isn't that enough?
Yeah.
Well, isn't that enough as in, do we need to merge the release dates?
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah. What I'm saying is the obvious advantage is for third-party developers, for maybe even proprietary software. It makes their life a lot easier to be able to build software which is multi-platform. But I can't see a real glowing benefit to this. As a user, it makes very little difference to me, because I know what distribution I'm using. I know what I'm going to be continue to be using. So I can't really see an obvious benefit.
Yeah.
Can you not see that some software might work for you but not work for me, and vice versa? Like, I might be running Fedora, and I've got the benefit that, Network Manager 7 is on mine, and you've got Network Manager 0.65 or something like that.
Well, I get used to that, same as you get used to what you're using. It, I don't know what you're using, so therefore I don't care.
Well, there is that. There is that. I'm in my work, my little Ubuntu bubble, and I don't care what anyone else is using. That's my point, yeah.
All right. Thank you for your thoughts on that. Let's go move along to our next story. Open source standards are making headway here in the States. NPR station WBUR in Boston adds support for free audio standard, the OGG player, or OGG Vorbis format, excuse me. Free Software Foundation has reported that in their playog.org campaign, with the announcement that the NPR radio station will now be webcasting in the free audio format OGG Vorbis. So what we need are more people, corporations, or entities to adopt this kind of file format, because it does come unencumbered and DRM free, so to speak. And it's a good thing. We, of course, kind of live in an MP3 kind of world, and it's kind of tough to switch people. And I don't understand why the switch is so difficult.
One of the big problems with all this media stuff is that there's no one universal format that works everywhere. On a Mac, you can open out-of-the-box MOV files and MP4 files. On a Windows machine, you can open WMVs and ASFs, but even some versions of those. And on a Linux machine, you're probably guaranteed to open OGGs and nothing else until you install special libraries. So this is the big thing that we're always fighting against, is that MP3 is basically ubiquitous. Once you've got the libraries installed on Windows, it works fine there. Same on a Mac, same on Linux. But obviously, we don't want to use MP3s, and Windows users and Mac users don't really have any philosophical reason not to use MP4s and MP3s, whereas we have philosophical, political, and objections to using those file formats. But we're the only people who do, and it's very hard to convince people that we're worthy people to listen to. For example, I used to download there's a video podcast called Dignation, which is something Kevin Rose and Alice Albrecht present, and they used to provide an Ogg feed, Ogg Vorbis Theora, and I used to download it. And then one day I noticed that I wasn't getting any more episodes, and I posted a message on the forum saying, hey, the Ogg feed is broken. And I got a reply from their administrator saying, yeah, we stopped doing it. Nobody listens to it. Nobody uses Ogg, I think was his words. I thought, oh, great. Thanks very much.
You know, nobody.
Clearly there are people who use Oggs, but it's you know, it is a minority, unfortunately.
Yeah. Say, Peter, I'll be right back, and if you could continue on without me for the next about 3 or 4 minutes,
we can do that.
Okay, great.
I can just make a comment about the Oggs. Regarding our podcast stats, I've noticed there's a significant more Oggs are being downloaded than MP3s. So I think in the Linux world, I think more people are at least listening to Ogg audio, which is a good thing.
Yeah, we don't...
Dave speaks and then a door slams.
Kaboom. Yeah, well, I guess that pretty much wraps up that discussion.
Oh, it's a home from home here, isn't it?
What was said now?
One of my colleagues was just stopped in to you know, check out for the day. He was heading home, and he just wanted to say goodbye. And so Dave finished talking about Ogg and you know, their download rates versus MP3s. And as he shut up, as he finished talking, the door slams shut. So we're just like, yeah, well, that pretty much ends that discussion right there. Yeah, actually, we didn't. Are you back now, Harlem?
Yeah, I'm sort of back. I'm in and out.
Okay.
My daughter's awake.
Okay. Well, we didn't go too much on that, but I think Dave wrapped up MP3 versus Oggs very nicely. Slam. our last news article for the week was the 25-year-old BSD bug. Gents, did you hear about this one?
Nope.
Oh, okay. This one was pretty funny. Apparently, a bug was found with, was found by some Samba users. And this bug manifested itself when you were accessing your Samba shares of your MS-DOS FAT file systems. I'm waiting for the laughter here. Apparently, MS-DOS.
Hang on,
yes.
You've got Samba shares on an MS-DOS system.
Correct. You're sharing MS-DOS file system types out. So you're not necessarily running MS-DOS, but you have MS-DOS file systems.
And you're sharing. Okay. Well, that's reasonable, isn't it? Your FAT 16, FAT 32.
Mm-hmm. Well, not FAT 32. That's not MS-DOS. FAT 32 was Windows 95 service pack in 98 and up. So yeah,
we're talking FAT 12 and FAT 16.
Exactly. Old FAT. Apparently, this bug was in BSD 4.2, which was released in August of 1983. So apparently, this bug was located and it has been fixed. But since it was in the code all the way back that far, apparently it's in all of the BSD releases, including OS 10. But so anyway, for those of you who are still using the MS-DOS file system on a BSD related operating system, you can now access it via Samba. That bug has been fixed. So we're sorry it took so long, but you know, 25 years or so, give or take, that you know, they're squashing them, so you give them some credit.
Phew, aren't we glad that one was fixed?
Only took 25 years.
You don't know how much productivity this one cost me, because I don't know about you guys, but I run FAT on all of my file systems because, you know, that whole defragmenting thing, it's a lot of fun. And personally, I think security and permissions and stuff, that's just blown way out of proportion. So, yeah, I'm a big FAT 16 kind of guy. Always.
Okay. Which one of you is actually running Windows right now? Because one of you is. I can hear Windows bleeps and bloops in the background.
I am.
Ah, there we go. So I'm glad it wasn't Peter that was doing the holier than thou, I don't run MS-DOS applications.
but do give me a chance to explain myself, because Hardy Heron.
No, I won't give you a chance to explain yourself. There's
no just come on. Moving on.
Thank you very much. Bye.
You don't have a chance.
Moving right along.
With that, I think that pretty much wraps up the news.
All right.
Good job, guys.
Wrapping up the news right now.
Longest news segment ever.
Sorry, guys.
So what do we have next, Peter?
I think we'll probably take a break and then maybe just talk about a couple of little things in our tech segment and then move on to listener feedback.
Okay. And we also have a man page minute this week, too. It's called the Z-Less, right?
You got that. That's right. Why don't we do that first?
Okay. We'll do the man page minute, and here it comes.
This week's man page minute is the command Z-Less. In for Peter Nicolaitis, I'm Emmett Stewart, a.k.a. Cafe Ninja. To use the command, you only need to type zless file name. Zless, simply put, is less for compressed files. If you read the man page, they will even tell you that it will not work if you pipe compressed data to it. The only use for this command is zless space filename.gz. When I say .gz, I really mean that part too. Zless will not even let you specify a file name that misses the GZ extension. I've taken a text file that was standard zipped and renamed it with GZ extension, which Zless allowed and opened correctly. This is the extreme end of the Unix philosophy of making one tool do one thing really well. This command is so overly simplified that there are no cool options or switches that make it do neat things. It is only less for a gzip file. That's it for this week's Man Page Minute. This is Cafe Ninja signing off.
Sorry, that does make us laugh.
This is the part of the show where Harlem makes clicking noises and he leaves them in the episode. Yeah.
So if we all do that, we randomly throughout the show go...
Then all that's going to happen is everyone will hear a bunch of click click clicks throughout the show.
Yep. Thanks a lot, guys.
Should we disconnect and let you get on with your professional show now?
Well, that would be fine. Peter?
Yes. Moving on. Okay, tech segments.
But first of all, these guys probably want to get going and get some rest.
Oh, right.
And perhaps even go back to the pub.
I don't know. It sounds to me like they've had enough, but you never can tell.
We've got wireless in the room. We don't need the pub.
Thank God for room service.
Yeah, it's okay. We've got the hint. You know, if you don't want us on the show anymore, we'll just go.
I want you guys to stick around, but it seems like Harlan's trying to get rid of you. I don't know.
All right, we'll let you carry on. Otherwise, this is going to be a 4-hour podcast.
One last thing, though. You have to explain to Cafe Ninja how you guys got your @ubuntu.com mailboxes. Yeah.
No, we'll have to tell you that if you get us on the show again.
Oh, okay.
Said last time.
We're going to hold you to that next week because we're going to do a Hardy Heron roundtable. You and, of course, Davey, you're also invited, provided you play nicely. And we'll have a bunch of us.
That'll be great, yeah.
So, anyway, thanks for joining us, gentlemen, and then we'll...
No problem. Sorry for giving you a ripping.
That's all right.
Okay, guys.
Bye. All right. Bye bye now.
Take care, guys.
So we are back and we are. Go ahead.
It's always fun having Alan and company on the show.
Yeah, it is. I'm glad that they joined us and then took the time to be with us. And, you know, it's getting late over there and I'm sure they're tired and, yeah, oh, yeah. And probably want to drink some more. So because I know I would too. So.
We should just change that. That wasn't the news segment. That was just like the hour and a half long banter segment with some news thrown in.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. There you go. So we're back from the Man Page Minute. Thanks for that, Cafe Ninja. And we appreciate all your hard work with that. And now we are going into user feedback. Is that right?
We can do some feedback.
What did you have planned?
I don't care. Let's do feedback. Okay. We can do feedback before the tech segment. Let's do that.
No, let's do the tech segment first because we have the links up anyway. So,
Oh, fine. Let's do the tech segment.
All right. Go ahead and start with your tech segment, and we'll just take it from there.
Okay. Well, first thing I've got is an article. I actually I called this one last week, but we didn't get to it. An article over at IBM on their DeveloperWorks site about migrating to EXT4. Now, I haven't done this on any of my systems. I confess I haven't even read through the entire article, but basically EXT4 will, you know, it's the successor to EXT3, and it likely will be the, you know, default Linux file system for most distros right. In the near future. I don't know. I haven't heard, I haven't looked at, like, the Intrepid IBEX schedule to see if they're going to throw in EXT4 support yet. But, you know, that's just if you want to prepare for that now, it talks about migrating to it, new features available. That's over at that IBM site, and we'll have a link to that in the show notes.
Excellent. Yep. Have a link to that in the show notes, migrating to EXT. Looks pretty complicated, and you should have a basically an intermediate level of, you know, I guess, computer knowledge. So.
Yeah, I wouldn't say, you know, I'm bored today. I think I'm going to migrate everything to EXT4. That's not my recommended course of action.
It might take you a little while.
Yeah, unless you have a very long day.
Yep, exactly. Plan for a few hours anyway to begin with. So, for those of you who are familiar with, say, the Filofax or even a Franklin Planner, but would like to upgrade to something more hip now and Web 2.0, or at least Command Line 2.0, you can check out todotext.com, where you can do your command or to-do list on the command line. And that, and this is probably what Richard Stallman uses for a day plan.
What would Stallman use as a task tracking tool? Yeah, he probably does.
Todo.txt, and it has a script there for your shell so that you can get your to-do list up and running through the command line. So I'll have that link in the show notes as well. And as a link for this week, a listener of ours submitted ubuntugeek.com, where you can get Ubuntu Linux tips, how-tos, tutorials for edgy, feisty, gutsy, and hardy. So check that site out at ubuntugeek.com. You have anything else?
Nope. I think that was pretty much it for TechSeg.
All right, well, that's going to do it for your tech segment. We'll be right back with the user feedback.
And somewhere, Alan and Davey are laughing their heads off at you right now.
All righty. Let me pull up my trusty mail client here and talk user feedback. Did you get much this week?
I got a few, and I got a voice message just before we started recording. I forwarded that on to you. Did you get that one too?
From Zerg.
Uh-huh.
Let me see.
Oh, man, I tell you.
Yeah, I got that.
Getting a little bit out of hand. I don't know. We're going to have to do something.
We'll figure something out. We'll figure something out. Let's see here. By the way, I'm hoping that you are going to be getting more user feedback, because I kind of fixed the site. I'm using a contact form. And I input your email address in there as well. So you'll be receiving some feedback from there, too.
Oh, excellent. You're not keeping all the good stuff to yourself anymore?
Not anymore. I've open sourced the messaging stuff. So
excellent.
So let's see here. For those of you who are having this problem, I'm hoping this is fixed. But there is a gentleman out there who is listening to our podcast who says he is having trouble opening the MP3 file, and he's downloading it and having to open it up in Audacity and exporting it to an MP3 in order for it to play, and hoping that it's an isolated case. I tried to do the same thing last week and found that it was okay under Windows. He is listening to it on a Windows machine, and I downloaded mine and listened to mine on a Windows machine and played just fine. And I know you did too, right, Peter?
Correct. Yeah, I didn't have any problems with it. So
yeah, so
hopefully it's just a setting on his side. But if anyone else has had any problems with the feed, by all means, drop us a note and let us know.
Yeah, and specifically the MP3 feed. And if they're having to do some kind of weird thing to it, but do let us know. You can send your feedback back to harlem@freshubuntu.org or peter@freshubuntu.org as well, and we'll try to get that fixed for you. Let's see, a comment from Robert.
I had one.
Okay, oh, go ahead. No, go.
Well, I had one actually from a couple of weeks ago, and unfortunately I never got to it. But I got a direct message on Twitter from Twitter user Gookin. Mm-hmm. And he said, "Good evening, Peter. Do you know if Ubuntu has a system testing software to test a computer? I have a P4 that runs like a P2. And I wasn't certain. I guess he's looking for just like an overall benchmarking package to just like, you know, basically, you know, benchmark your entire system's overall performance and possibly identify slowness or bottlenecks. So I didn't know if anyone else, if any of our listeners have any recommendations. I did some searching a little bit for some benchmarking stuff, but mostly it was, you know, like system profilers to test your own code and, you know, benchmark your own software that you're writing, not so much just like an overall how's my system rating kind of thing. So if anybody has anything like that, drop us a note, and we'll be sure to let him know. Or I suppose you could, just drop us a note. That's
yeah.
Nice.
Mm-hmm. This one from Matt. He says, "Where can I find a complete listing of your podcast and their download links? The feed only lists episodes back to episode 46. And when I read this, I said, oh, thank God you can only go back to episode 46. Because quite honestly, every now and again, I just shudder when I first started this podcast. It was just, I think, the worst podcast ever. I'm sure lots of podcasters are feeling the same way with their first, you know, half a dozen, two dozen even. It's really miles, tons better, light years better since Peter's gotten on here, and, you know, we've had a lot more fun and a lot more interactivity. And, episode 46 is probably the furthest back you want to go to. So just a note. Thanks, Matt, for sending us that. Otherwise, if you really wanted to, you'd have to go to freshubuntu.org and then go back to the very first post and get it from there. So there you go. One from John Tyndale. He says, "I know you guys were talking about OLPC a couple of weeks ago. Here's an official article," and he lists technologyreview.com/biztech, blah, 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 and I'll post that in the show notes. Thank you for that link, John. And by the way, if there is a link that people want to let us know about, go ahead and mark it in your delicious tags for /FreshUbuntu. And that way, both Peter and I can get a look at it well ahead of time. And you don't have to email it to us. You can just send us that link through your delicious account. Again, that link is, or that tag, is /FreshUbuntu. Basically, I think that's it. I got a voicemail from Randy, one of Randy's rants, okay, as he would call it. So let me pull that up real quickly. By the way, when he's going to say something at the very beginning that might be construed as a NSFW type of word, but it's not. And let me spell it for you. He'll say something spelt like FUP, FUP, and that's can be misconstrued as an NSFW kind of word, which it is not. And but I'm gonna play his soundbite here real quick. And
I can't wait.
Hey, FUP crew, it's Randy with one of Randy's rants. So, I'm just sitting here thinking about this whole Microsoft and the OLPC and that, and, you know, the ULPC market with Microsoft. And there's people saying, you know, Microsoft is trying to do it to kill Linux. And I don't think they're really targeting Linux for this. It really wouldn't matter who's doing it. It's just the fact that Microsoft isn't doing it, so they're getting jealous. They're seeing someone else being successful, and it makes them nervous in a market where they've been the 800-pound gorilla. You know, that's why they're trying. Why they were trying to buy the whole Yahoo deal. They wanted to try to outdo Google. Which, why is Microsoft trying to outdo Google when you know, why can't Microsoft concentrate on making an operating system that people like and works, and win people over by having something that's decent and good, rather than trying to blackmail them into their operating system like they did in the beginning. That's my take on things, guys. Anyway, have a good week. Bye.
Randy, thank you very much for that voicemail. And of course, you can always try our web call button on the website at freshubuntu.org. Go ahead and give that a shot. I don't know, Peter, what do you think about his comments?
About Microsoft making a better operating system,
yeah,
or something like that?
Yeah, he talked about Microsoft making a better operating system instead of arm-twisting people to, you know.
I don't know, man. I just, they're... I don't have a rant in me today, so I'm just going to let it slide.
All right. Thanks for that, Randy, and... again, we appreciate your comments, and if anyone would like to chime in on that, you can go ahead and email it to us at peter@freshubuntu.org or at harlem@freshubuntu.org, or you can use the contact form on the website at freshubuntu.org. Guess who called again? I got another message from our intergalactic space friend.
Oh, here we go again.
Yeah, it's affecting the show, man. It's affecting the show.
I tell you.
Anyway, I'm going to play
it. Let's get it over with.
I'm going to play it and all right, see what we got.
Peter, and the rest of Fresh Ubuntu, this is the only galactic overlord, Zerg, coming to you once again to give a little note of quality to your transmissions. Well, it looks like you have mobilized quite the army. Not only is Cafe of the Ninja and Harlem behind you and is having your back, Peter, also the Peace Penguin. Well, Peace Penguin, you might come in peace, but you will be going to pieces. On another note, I have been trying out the olive branch that you have been offering. I've been playing with Hearty Heron, the Ubuntu install you talk so fondly about, and must say I am quite pleased. I was even on the verge of declaring peace between the Galactic Overlord Zerg and, well, the Earthlings. But then you made matters worse. You sent me a grilled cheese sandwich. Are you insane? Don't you know that on our planet, a grilled cheese sandwich is considered an enormous insult? Why do you insult me like this, Harlan? It looks like you are the evil brain behind Peter, and he is nothing but a sock puppet. Well, well, Harlan of Fresh Ubuntu, you are very close to peace, but if you want a war, you can have one. Expect my answer to your grilled cheese sandwich in next week's episode. This was Zerg.
Zerg, Zerg, Zerg.
Oh, boy.
What do you got to say about that, Peter?
I mean,
Perhaps, maybe we're going to have to wiki where this Zerg fella comes from and, you know, find out what his likes are.
Have to look that up. I mean, dude, how can you go wrong with a grilled cheese sandwich? I mean, come on.
Everybody loves grilled cheese.
Apparently, that's a big insult where he comes from. I didn't know. Zerg, I'm sorry, all right? Unless saying that you're sorry from your planet is an insult. In that case, B beep you. There. But maybe that'll get his attention. I don't know. Who knows?
There you go.
I'm dead. Yeah, we'll try everything.
Yep, we will try.
Or should we just say, should we say to Zerg, fup crew?
We can say that too. So
okay.
That's all I got for this week. You got anything else?
I'm good.
Oh, hey, by the way, one last thing. I'll mention it right now. We have the new logo, right? Well,
yes.
We have t-shirts, and I will post that link in the show notes. And so for those of you who want t-shirts, you can get t-shirts. Just go to freshubuntu.org. It's a cafe press site, you know, kind of whatever. But
always holding out on me. You give me the emails, but you don't tell me about the t-shirts. Oh, boy.
I've been working on it all week, trying to get the graphic just right. The graphic will not include, Ubuntu logo. I just kind of want to avoid any of the whatever trademark issues there are. But
and this is the thanks I get.
But don't worry, Peter, we'll get you one for free one of these days. And we can both show off our Fresh Ubuntu Podcast t-shirts. And by the way, we have other kinds of things, you know, hats, mugs, et cetera, so. Anyway, if you want to support the site that way, you can go right ahead and grab one of those t-shirts. But that's going to do it for our user feedback. You got anything else in terms of feedback?
I'm good. I'm going to go make myself a grilled cheese sandwich.
Oh, okay. That is not an insult, by the way. So that is going to do it for us this week. Thank you very much, Peter, for joining me. Thanks again to the Ubuntu UK crew, or at least half of them, for joining us this week. They're at the Ubuntu Development Summit in Prague, and we thank you for taking time out of your drinking schedule to join us. And we are going to have Alan and Davey possibly back next week for the Hardy Heron Roundtable. We'll have a large group of people talking specifically about their likes and dislikes of Hardy Heron, the long-term support release. Again, our email addresses are at harlem@freshubuntu.org and peter@freshubuntu.org. And you can also go to the website for the show notes at freshubuntu.org. And that's going to do it for us this week. Peter, say goodbye, Peter.
Goodbye, Peter.
All right. Thanks very much for joining us. And we will chat again real soon. Bye-bye now.